The Guardian.
Hello, this is Science Weekly, and most dogs call me... That was ultrasound for Alok Jar. This week's show is a distinctly canine affair. Biologist John Bradshaw is one of the world's leading dog experts and the author of In Defense of Dogs, Why Dogs Need Our Understanding. The book explores recent DNA evidence and archaeology to trace the evolution of the dog from a wild, threatening wolf into the domesticated pets some of us keep today. Along the way, John discusses our understanding of dog psychology and the ethical implications of breeding show dogs from an ever-shrinking gene pool. So when I met him, my nose was wet and my tail wagging at the chance of discussing man's best friend. Also, whilst making this edition of Science Weekly, we discovered that where there's a dog owner with a doggy story.
My dog's name's Reggie, and he calls me Scott. He's a Doberman, and he's just coming up to 5 years old now, and I've had him since he was a pup. My most challenging memory of him, and probably my strongest memory, has been when he was about 18 months old or so. And he stays at home for a period during the day while I'm at work. And I came in one evening to find that he'd eaten the sofa. The living room was quite a sight, as you can probably imagine. So, a sofa was eventually bought and replaced the eaten one. And to try and counteract this and stop this happening again, we bought a webcam, which we connected up to the internet and was very handy, so we were able to keep an eye on him during the day and see what he was doing. But then comes the problem that when you're sat at work and you're seeing your dog tearing up your living room, what do you actually do? How do you stop that? And so I had tried a few times to call the answering machine and shout messages down the phone to him, but it didn't really seem to have much effect. So what we worked out in the end really was that you have to correct his behaviour as it happens. 20 seconds later and it's too late, it's all over. He thinks you're telling him off for standing up and walking out of the room or something like that. It has to be done instantly and when it's there. And so the webcam's been quite nice to see him lazing around in my living room in the afternoons now, but realised that it's not actually a useful method of correcting dog behaviour.
So John, why don't we start with sort of the real background evolutionary history of dogs. Where did the ancestors of dogs come from?
Well, there's kind of a lot of recent DNA work which suggests that they came from parts of Europe and or Asia. But that's still controversial as to exactly whereabouts in those areas they came from. And probably the answer is that everybody's right, that there were several different domestications in different parts of Eastern Europe, Western Asia and Eastern Asia as well. One authority claims that dogs were domesticated in southern China, northern Vietnam, that area, as part of the bamboo culture that was going on at the time. So we're talking 20,000 years ago or so. The problems with that culture are that there's very little archaeology, and what archaeology there is very difficult because they didn't have very many stone artifacts. So we don't know much about it. Other people are claiming that they originated in Europe, but everybody's agreed, the total unanimous agreement, that it was the wolf that was the original ancestral species, and not, as for example Conrad Lorenz claimed, the jackal.
And so was it a specific species of wolf that it came from, or were there different ones that involved?
Well, there was only one species of wolf, but there's probably a lot of variation within that species. There isn't nearly so much variation today because we've essentially pushed wild wolves out into bits of the world that we don't want, essentially. They're dangerous to agriculture. They chase and eat livestock and so on. So they're very persecuted species. So the way I conceive it is that there were originally quite a lot of different kinds of wolves, all the same species, but perhaps with quite different types of behaviour. Some of those wolves moved into human society and became what we now know as dogs. Others were not temperamentally suited to that and hang on now as kind of relic populations in various parts of the world where they're still allowed to exist.
And so your book is kind of a parts of it are a history of the human co-evolution with the animals that became dogs. Both sides sort of adapted to the other. At what point did that begin? You mentioned populations of wolves moving into human societies. When did that start to happen, and how did it start to happen?
Well, it's very uncertain when it actually started to happen. There's still ongoing archaeology. I think most archaeologists until recently would say 15,000 years ago was about the limit, which is at the time when dogs first started appearing in graves, deliberately buried with what were presumably their masters. By which they can be pretty sure that these animals were part of society and not an accidental part. They weren't just food or being kept for their fur or anything like that. They were pets, essentially, by that point. Where it's much more difficult to examine is further back as to how that process, how the wolf turned into that pet animal, which not only didn't look like a wolf anymore, but didn't behave like one either. And there are some intriguing, they're pretty patchy, but some intriguing discoveries that go back another 15,000 years in France, so to about 30,000 years ago, which suggests that even at that stage, there were very wolf-like animals, but living with people. So they looked like wolves, but they probably didn't behave like wolves, and they were living with people. Now, whether those animals are the direct ancestors of the dogs we have today, or whether they were an initial, perhaps failed domestication, which then wasn't repeated, perhaps for another few thousand years, I mean, it's still, we just don't know. There isn't enough evidence.
My dog's name is Bear, and he was called Bear. He's not alive anymore. And he calls me Nina. Well, he used to call me Nina. Okay, so Bear was a beautiful German Shepherd dog with long hair behind his ears. It was all fluffy. And we rescued him from from Fole Farm, like a dog rescue place. And then one day we went away on holiday. We gave him to our dog sitter, who also have a dog called Elvis. And that was his best buddy for a while. And Lloyd, who's the dog owner of Elvis, took him out for a walk. And Bear lost sight of him in the park. It's quite a sad story, I have to say. So he bolted out the park looking for Lloyd desperately and got run over and broke his back. Really sad. And Lloyd was so desperate, he gave him mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, which, yeah, you can laugh about it now, but he was just so upset, this guy. He was like, I've lost your dog. Like, he's the most amazing dog ever. My mum just adored him. And my mum's never got over it. Until recently, we rescued another dog who looks just like Bear. It's amazing. We've had like three in between that time as well, and they've just not cut the mustard. And we've had to send them back. So we have a new dog now. His name is Roman, and he's a very similar dog to Bear, and he's lovely.
Well, certainly by sort of 10,000 years ago, we're pretty sure that there were different breeds for different purposes. However much it may offend modern Western sensibilities, there were almost certainly breeds of dog that were bred for fur, as meat animals and for fur. They were probably that was probably associated with some kind of prestige function, because the dog is not a productive animal in terms of meat or fur. It's much easier in those times to have gone out and killed a wild animal and used that. So presumably there was some kind of social context within which this happened. There were also breeds of dog that sort of 10,000 years ago, which clearly were bred for guarding, big, heavy, mastiff-type dogs. There were small dogs used for hunting. So already by that stage, we see diversification within the dog for particular functions. Where I think there's much less certainty is where what the original function of the dog was in human society. Some people have said it was a refuse disposer. Some people have said it was a pet. Some people have said, I think rather fancifully, that it was originally domesticated for hunting. I don't quite see how that latter one would have worked. But it's a matter for lots of speculation and not many facts.
Now, the dog genome, the Canis familiaris genome, was sequenced just over a decade ago, and there's some, obviously it sheds light on a lot of the history that we've just been talking about in terms of their relationships with wolves and also, you know, our relationships with humans. I mean, they're 25% of their genes are the same as ours, human genes. What did that genetic analysis tell you about the variations in the breeds that we see? Because obviously it's some of the most diverse single species in the world.
That's right. I mean, the dog is extraordinarily diverse. It comes in more shapes and sizes than any other carnivore. The DNA sequencing hasn't actually, I don't think, given us all the answers as to how that diversification took place. But what it has told us is about different breeds of dog. There are a few ancient breeds which seem to have maintained separation for hundreds, maybe thousands of years. That's not to say they weren't interbred with other dogs, but that generally and largely they were kept separate. There's a whole bunch of breeds in the Far East, things like the Shiba Inu and the Chow Chow. There are breeds in Western Asia, like the Saluki and Afghan Hound. There's the Bazenji in Africa, which is genetically pretty much unique, although it's still derived from the wolf, but a long, long time ago. And then there are the sled-pulling dogs, the Siberian Husky and the Alaskan Malamute, which are recent back crosses with wolves and, again, have genetic separation. Any other dog, pretty much any other breed you care to name, is part of a massive interbreeding and then selection experiment that really started about 150 years ago. So, but up to that point, lots of interbreeding so that none of these modern breeds can trace their ancestry very far, at least not unique ancestry.
What kinds of modern breeds are we talking
about?
Well,
if we talk, for example, about the Golden Retriever, it's an incredibly popular family dog all over the world. That's descended from a very small number of retrievers that were originally black, had a mutation, got a yellow coat. That seemed to be very appealing. And so they trace their ancestry back to a very small number of animals about 100 years ago. So, you know, we may think of them as ubiquitous today, but if you went back to mid-Victorian times, there wouldn't be any Golden Retrievers. They simply didn't exist.
There's going to obviously be more understood about the sort of variations in the genetics. But do you think that in our quest, in some people's quest to make ever more pure breeds, I mean, some people have been critical of this particular idea of having very pure breeds and all that. Can you just take us through why that is a bad idea? Why things like that are bad for this species?
Well, whether it's bad for the species or not, I think is debatable, because there's still lots of genetic variation in the dog as a whole. I think what it's bad for is the welfare of the individual dogs, or it can be bad for the welfare of the individual dogs. And I'm not trying to suggest that every pedigree dog suffers simply because it has papers. That's not the case at all. But there are essentially two kinds of problems that can arise and are getting worse. I think most people are agreed, although, you know, there are steps now being taken to make them better. One is that some breeds have been bred into very extreme morphological shapes so that they have difficulties in breathing and moving around, and a particular interest of mine is signalling that dogs are bred with very short coats, which means they can't raise their hackles, and they're bred with very short tails, which means they can't wag them properly. And so we now know from observational work we've done, these dogs do sometimes have difficulty in communicating with other dogs. So there is that issue of some of these shapes, which are derived for human aesthetic reasons. People like to have weird-looking dogs. Up to a point, maybe that's okay, but there becomes a point where it compromises the welfare. The other issue is the line breeding that takes place within breeds. If you want to register an animal as a pedigree, you have to, it's both its parents and all its grandparents and its great-grandparents all have to, have, and so on, back down the line, have to be from the same breed. Because the breeds are essentially, the breed standards are based on competition between individuals. Only one dog each year can win the best in show and that sort of thing. It means that very small numbers of dogs get bred from to any great extent. And so the amount of variation within breeds decreases and decreases and decreases. So back in the 1950s, for example, some American geneticists looked at some popular American breeds and said, actually, they're genetically pretty healthy. 50 years of line breeding hadn't really done any damage. Look at them again in the 21st century, and the same techniques will say, actually, these breeds are all in trouble. Many of them, every single individual in a breed is is more closely related than two human cousins would be. So the amount of variation is tiny. And what you get is inbreeding depression, as it's called, the appearance of traits which previously are masked because they're heterozygous, they become homozygous, and so you get all manner of disorders appearing, which can be very difficult to breed out.
My dog's name was Ambrose, and he called me Jason. He was a Yorkshire Terrier, and he actually came from quite a good breeder, but he was the bad one in the batch. He was beautiful to us, but he had buck teeth. His legs were a little bit too long for his breed. He was a little bit too big. And then he had a very odd thing, which was that he couldn't ever really walk in a straight line. He always veered off to the left. So he was no good to be sold at proper prices. So my father got him at a knockdown rate, took him home, and he was, a blessing and a curse from then on. So Ambrose, although he was a very beautiful little dog, was quite aggressive, very possessive of my mother, and followed her around endlessly, just gazing at her, and it drove her around the bend. Now, my mother became quite ill and died, but in that final year of her life, when she probably wasn't at her best, she had a few attempts at getting rid of this annoying dog, and I think at least two attempts were made to bring him down to a vet to be put down. But on both occasions, my mother finally saw the better of it, and I think my younger sister intervened. So he ended up surviving my mother. My mother passed away, unfortunately, and Ambrose managed to survive the wrath of my mother, which was no mean feat, I can tell you.
One of the things that you talk about in the book also is human-dog relations, and specifically, if you, I don't have a dog myself, but speaking to anyone who does, they're convinced that their dog has a whole range of emotions that are complex, and probably they can do abstract thoughts, and they smile and they wince and all of these things. Your book sort of demolishes some of this stuff. Can you just take us through some of the misconceptions that dog owners might have about how their dogs are feeling every day?
Right. Well, I mean, I think the first conception they have, which is that their dogs love them, and I think, you know, very few people don't think that, and the science suggests that it overwhelmingly suggests that they do. Dogs essentially are bonded to humans. They do what they're told to do because they love us, not because they're scared of us, although some people treat their dogs like that. They don't have to. Dogs will naturally form bonds with humans. We've done research which suggests that a dog, particularly an abandoned dog, will start to form an attachment to a particular person within 15 minutes of meeting them, which is quite staggering. I mean, I think, you know, we wouldn't necessarily do that within 15 minutes of meeting somebody. So dogs are a lot more trusting, perhaps, than humans are.
I mean, you write actually that dogs like humans more than they like other dogs.
Yeah, I mean, obviously that does depend a little bit on the way the dog's brought up. A dog that doesn't get to meet very many people when it's very young may not be able to form very good attachments. It may even be scared of people or some kinds of people. But the average dog, it seems to be kind of programmed into it by presumably as a result of domestication to form very strong bonds with people right from almost the minute the puppy's eyes start to open, and go on doing that pretty much throughout its life, because obviously dogs can change from owners and don't necessarily suffer as a result.
And what about these sort of more complex, other complex emotions like jealousy and happiness and, you know, the separation anxiety and all these things that you see?
Yeah, I mean, separation anxiety, I tend to call it separation disorders because some of them are related to anxiety and some are not. But in general, they're the flip side of this very strong attachment that dogs feel for us. We kind of want them to love us, but then we also want them to be able to switch that off when we go away. And dogs actually find that rather difficult. So a lot of them don't like being left. Jealousy is, again, a kind of fairly complex emotion, but such research has been done suggests that dogs can actually feel jealousy because it involves, so long as it involves something in the here and now. So if a dog sees his or her owner petting another dog, they will... you can see them do it. They kind of try and push the other dog out of the way. They're clearly trying to break that attachment, which they see as a sort of mild threat, perhaps, to their attachment to their owner. I don't think that dogs can brood about it. They don't go away into their bed and think, oh, my owner was petting Flossie today. I'm really cross about that. I don't think they brood about it like that. But they do have the in-the-moment version of jealousy, where, you know, I think the science takes parts company with owners in kind of automatic perceptions is for emotions like guilt, where the research suggests that that dogs don't feel guilt. They're not capable of thinking back to an incident that's happened in the past and associating it with a bad feeling. If they're going to get a bad feeling, it's going to be about what's happening right now in front of them. So an owner that punishes a dog when he or she comes home for something the dog did 2 hours ago, the dog is simply going to go, well, sometimes when my owner comes home, I get punished. Sometimes I don't. I really don't know what to take from that. And that can make the dog almost permanently anxious.
How do you do experiments in this way? Is it all observational, or can you actually test this stuff out?
Well, a lot of it's, in my case, almost all of it's been observational. But the experiments on guilt, which were done in New York, were actually done in a kind of very simple experimental paradigm where dogs were, the researcher recruited dogs and their owners the dogs had been trained to not to take food treats when they were told not to. So these were all very obedient dogs. They took the dog into a room away from the owner and then either did or didn't give it a treat. They then brought the owner back in again and then told the owner that the dog had either taken the treat or had refused it. And that was completely randomized with what had actually happened. And the dog's behavior was consistent in terms of what the owners had been told, not in terms of what they'd done. So if the owners had been told that the dog had misbehaved, the dogs looked guilty, whether or not they had actually done anything to feel guilty about. And the interpretation is that when the owners come back in and they're told that the dog's done something wrong, their body language changes. They get ready to scold the dog, and the dog immediately reacts, going, oops, I'm just about to be scolded. And then the owner, who hasn't realized their body language has changed, interprets that as the guilt feeling. But guilt requires this thinking back, which we think dogs are not, other work suggests dogs are not really capable of doing. We think that's kind of where dogs' emotional repertoire stops and ours carries on.
So in a sense, you can kind of only talk about the dog's psychology in relation to people.
My dog's name is Snorky the Hopper, and she knows my name is Shauna. I'm not the only one who feels that she has quite a complex inner world. All my friends, when they come round, they say, oh God, look, she's smiling at me. And most people think that they can actually read her facial expressions in the same way that you might read a person's, probably because she is a people person. And she really knows when I'm upset or ill, and she'll go in the next room and won't talk to me until I'm back to normal again. She can't bear that. She gets into bed with us every morning and puts her head on the pillow and stays in bed till about lunchtime, I think, like a sort of depressed teenager. If she can get her hands on anything that she can sort of tear into small pieces or, break up into its component parts. I've had a sort of series of lodgers who've had their toothbrushes confiscated by her, and she sort of takes them away and holds them between her paws.
You say in the book also that you're calling for us to reassess our relationships with dogs. And I just wanted to know, if you could just unpack that a little bit. What is it you think that has changed in the 20th and going forward into the 21st century? What is changing as regards the way we live or the way we interact with dogs that is difficult for those animals, and how do we change it?
Well, I think, if we go back to the 19th century and back before that, dogs were essentially part of the working landscape. They did things for people. There were a few dogs kept primarily for company, but most of them were kept for some other reason as well. I'm not saying they weren't companions, because self-evidently they were. You've only got to see somebody who works with dogs nowadays to see how the basic affection between dog and handler actually contributes to the working relationship. But the primary function of dogs was to do things for us, and they've done a whole range of things. It's one of the reasons why the dogs have been so successful as a species, is that they're so adaptable in terms of the tasks they can perform. But now most people keep dogs for companionship, and most people live in small households. I mean, this is another change, just a demographic change. Dogs like company. We've bred them to like company. When there were 10 people living in a house, there was always somebody there. Now, there are lots of households of one and two. It's very often the dog has to be left alone if those people want to have a dog. And so one thing we I think everyone has to do now is to... Dogs can be taught how to adapt to that, but they have to be taught. They can't be expected to just adapt to it. They need to be taught how to be left alone. And there's a whole section in the book on how to do that. But more generally than that, I think we're also needing to look at the kinds of dogs we're breeding, that dogs are either bred for the show ring, in which case they're pedigree animals, and the looks of the dog is paramount. I'm not saying they're not being bred for companionship, but that's not the number one function. Or we're getting dogs from rescue shelters. We're going down to Battersea Dogs Home or whatever and getting a staffy that's probably been mistreated in its past and certainly, almost certainly, the result of some irresponsible breeding. So if somebody says, look, I want a dog for companionship, no one has actually ever designed a dog for companionship yet. And I think that there is an increasing movement coming out of science, coming out of scientists, particularly actually in Australia, to get a movement going among breeders to say, look, let's leave the show ring to one side. People want a dog that looks cute, but they don't care whether its parents have really won a prize or not. That what they want is a dog that functions in 21st century urban society, can be left alone easily, is easy to train, is easy to groom, to look after, isn't neurotic, and so on. And let's breed for that. And I think that's, you know, that if we can do that, I think we'll ensure dogs of a future in this next century.
How do people, dog lovers, and there are many, many, many of them in this country and others, how do they react to the sort of the new ideas that you're suggesting? I mean, are they accepting of them? I mean, some of this might sound quite designed and a bit too scientific, if you like.
Well, I think, I mean, there's a kind of, I think people have different perceptions of science, and I think that's a general trend in society. Some people like science and some people regard it as something they don't really want to engage with. So I think that's a more general issue. I don't think it's really got anything to do with dogs. The dog training community, it isn't really a community. It's basically a collection of people who argue with one another all the time. So some of them really like what I say and some people don't. I don't think it's a great deal I can do about that. So somebody once said, if you put 10 dog trainers in a room together, they would disagree about everything. So, that I think is just a fact of life. The purpose of the book really is to get that science out to owners who can take advantage of the science that's there and then make their own choices about what kind of a dog they want to get, how they want to get their dog trained, and so on. There's been some controversy around it, but I'm hoping that basically what I'm presenting here is science. It's not my opinions. It's my interpretations, but it's not my opinions of how people should look after their dogs. I'm simply saying this is the new science. There's been a lot done over the last 10 years that hasn't got out there into the media in general. Here it is. Use it for whatever reasons or purposes you want.
Just final question. You've had many dogs in your lifetime. What was your favourite breed?
Well, all the dogs that I've had have been Labradors or Labrador crosses. So that's kind of accidental, but with hindsight, I guess that means I'm hooked on Labradors.
Would you consider others?
Of course, yeah. You know, if I had another lifetime, I should probably have had a wider range of experiences of dogs. But, you know, I approach dogs as a scientist. My personal experiences of dogs are something that's helped. But none of the ideas that I talk about in the book are really... they may be inspired by some of my own dogs, but they're all based on hundreds of dogs that I and my colleagues have studied over the years.
John Bradshaw, thank you very much.
Pleasure.
Huge thanks there to John Bradshaw and all our dog owners for their contributions. In Defence of Dogs is published by Penguin and available at The Guardian online bookshop and other virtual and real outlets. I'll be back next week, but you can keep up to speed with breaking science news at any time on guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. But from me, Alok Jha, and Science Weekly producer, Ruff Ruff, it's goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.